It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
I'm Melissa Block, and you're listening to All Tech Considered. Many investors expect Facebook to file papers this week for an initial public offering. The company, founded in a Harvard dorm less than a decade ago, is expected to be valued at $80 to $100 billion. From Silicon Valley, NPR's Steve Henn reports.
If the early reports are true, this is shaping up to be the biggest internet IPO ever.
It'll be larger than the Google IPO, larger than the Amazon IPO, and the largest internet IPO in history.
Kathleen Smith tracks initial public offerings at Renaissance Capital.
It's rumored that they will seek to raise $10 billion in their IPO.
And Smith expects the deal could value Facebook at something close to $100 billion. It could create something like 1,000 new Facebook millionaires and give Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook's 27-year-old CEO, a net worth north of $20 billion, at least on paper. So this leads to the question, is Facebook really worth this? Or is this another internet bubble in the making?
This is a very expensive company, let's face it.
Sam Hamada follows the tech industry and Wall Street at Privco.
So at $100 billion, you're talking about one of the largest companies in the United States, or most valuable companies in the United States. The upside is reasonably limited.
Hamada says Facebook would have to grow like a weed for years to justify its stock price. And other analysts agree. They say investors who buy shares are betting that it will more than quadruple in size. The reason investors in Wall Street are optimistic is that the company actually has been growing like a weed for years. Deborah Aho Williamson is an analyst at eMarketer. She estimates last year Facebook's revenue more than doubled. The year before that, it tripled. But she thinks this year that 100% growth rate will fall by half.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that you know, Facebook's a failure or that Facebook has done something wrong. I mean, you know, 50% revenue growth in advertising is still huge and enormous and very, you know, something that most media properties would salivate over, right?
And Williamson believes there will be myriad ways for Facebook to make money down the road.
The real reason why investors are valuing Facebook so highly is because of the promise. They think that Facebook might be what the future of how we use the internet.
Investors seem eager to bet billions that Facebook's grand future actually comes to pass. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Audie Cornish. From Gandhi and Joe DiMaggio to Mother Teresa and Bill Gates, introverts have done a lot of great things in the world, but being quiet, introverted, or shy was sometimes looked at as a problem to be overcome.
If you're what they call a shy guy, you're standing on the outside looking in. You might have something to contribute to their conversation, but nobody cares whether you do or not. There's a barrier, and you don't know how to begin breaking it down.
In the 1940s and 50s, the message to most Americans was don't be shy. And in the era of reality television, Twitter, and relentless self-promotion, it seems that cultural mandate is in overdrive. A new book tells the story of how things came to be this way, and it's called Quiet: The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. The author is Susan Cain, and she joins us from the NPR studios in New York to talk more about it. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here, Audie.
Well, we're happy to have you. And to start out, I think we should get this on the record. Do you consider yourself an introvert or an extrovert?
Oh, I definitely consider myself an introvert. And that was part of the fuel for me to write the book.
And what's the difference between being an introvert versus being shy? I mean, what's your definition?
So introversion is really about having a preference for lower stimulation environments. So it's just a preference for quiet, for less noise, for less action, whereas extroverts really crave more stimulation in order to feel at their best. And what's important to understand about this is that many people believe that introversion is about being antisocial, and that's really a misperception, because actually it's just that introverts are differently social. So they would prefer to have, you know, a glass of wine with a close friend as opposed to going to a loud party full of strangers. Now, shyness, on the other hand, is about a fear of negative social judgment. So you can be introverted without having that particular fear at all, and you can be shy but also be an extrovert.
And in the book, you say that there's a spectrum. So if some people are listening and they think, well, I too like a glass of wine and a party, it's like we all have these tendencies.
Yeah, yeah, that's an important thing. And in fact, Carl Jung, the psychologist who first popularized these terms all the way back in the 1920s, even he said there is no such thing as a pure introvert or a pure extrovert. And he said such a man would be in a lunatic asylum.
That makes me worry because I took your test in the book and I'm like 90% extrovert, basically. Now, you mentioned going back into the history, and I want to talk more about that because I was really fascinated by how you showed how this extrovert ideal, you call it, came to be. When did being introverted move from being a character trait to being looked at as a problem?
Yeah, what I found is, to some extent, we've always had an admiration for extroversion in our culture. But the extrovert ideal really came to play at the turn of the 20th century when we had the rise of big business. And so suddenly, people were flocking to the cities and they were needing to prove themselves in big corporations at job interviews and on sales calls. And so at that moment in time, we moved from what cultural historians call a culture of character to a culture of personality. So during the culture of character, what was important was the good deeds that you performed when nobody was looking. You know, Abraham Lincoln is the embodiment of the culture of character, and people celebrated him back then for being a man who did not offend by superiority. But at the turn of the century, when we moved into this culture of personality, suddenly what was admired was to be magnetic and charismatic. And then at the same time, we suddenly had the rise of movies and movie stars. And movie stars, of course, were the embodiment of what it meant to be a charismatic figure. And so part of people's fascination with these movie stars was for what they could learn from them and bring with them to their own jobs.
Now, how does this thinking affect the workplace today?
Well, you know, I would say it's quite a problem in the workplace today because we have a workplace that is increasingly set up for maximum group interaction. More and more of our offices are set up as open plan offices where there are no walls and there's very little privacy. And in fact, the average amount of space per employee actually shrunk from 500 square feet in the 1970s to 200 square feet today. And also, introverts are much less often groomed for leadership positions, even though there's really fascinating research out recently from Adam Grant at Wharton, finding that introverted leaders often deliver better outcomes when their employees are more proactive. They're more likely to let those employees run with their ideas, whereas an extroverted leader might almost unwittingly be more dominant and be putting their own stamp on things, and so those good ideas never come to the fore.
Of course, getting to that theory of, like, the loudest ideas aren't necessarily the best ideas.
Right,
except in brainstorming sessions, right? I mean, it sounds like some of these team-building things, in a way, don't stamp out good ideas, but certainly make it hard for those of us who aren't as loud.
Yeah, and none of this is to say that it would be a good thing to get rid of teamwork and to get rid of group work altogether. It's more just to say that we're at a point in our culture and in our workplace culture where we've gotten too lopsided. And we tend to believe that all creativity and all productivity comes from the group, when in fact, there really is a benefit to solitude and to being able to kind of go off and focus and put your head down.
Susan, I have to admit, as I read the book more and more, I became more and more offended as an extrovert. I felt like, wait a second, I listen to people in meetings, you know, I like felt sort of sheepish.
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, that's so not the intention. My criticism in the book is not of extroverts at all, but rather of the extrovert ideal. I actually find extroversion to be a really appealing personality style. And this sounds like a funny thing, but many of my best friends truly are extroverts, including my beloved husband.
All my best friends are extroverts. Okay, well, I believe you. And I had a great time talking with you. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Adi. I appreciate it.
That's Susan Cain, author of Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. And if all this talk has you thinking, who am I? Introvert, extrovert, ambivert? Yes, that's really a thing. Well, you can take Susan Cain's quiz at npr.org.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. To find out more about the books and authors you hear on NPR's programs, go to npr.org/books. There you'll find author interviews, NPR's bestseller lists, and find out what our staff is reading. This is NPR. Freddie Mac is a gatekeeper in the mortgage market. In many cases, the taxpayer-owned mortgage company controls who qualifies to refinance a mortgage and who doesn't. Well, NPR has learned that Freddie Mac has been making financial wagers, betting against American homeowners being able to refinance. And now some lawmakers want to put a stop to it. NPR's Chris Arnold has been reporting this story in partnership with ProPublica.org. He has this report.
A home loan has two payment streams, the more stable principal payments and the interest payments. Freddie Mac here has tied up billions of dollars on investments that isolate just those interest rate payments. So that means that if somebody refinances, they stop paying Freddie Mac anything, and Freddie loses money. Freddie Mac has also been making it harder for Americans to refinance through tighter rules and higher fees. No evidence has emerged that these two actions have been coordinated, but the trades raise concerns.
No, I was outraged that this basic conflict of interest existed.
That's Democratic Senator Bob Casey from Pennsylvania. He sent a letter to President Obama today asking him to direct Freddie Mac to put an end to these practices immediately. And Casey says he supports legislation to direct Fannie and Freddie to allow millions more people to refinance.
There are a lot of families out there that can benefit tremendously from a policy that encourages and gives more opportunities for refinancing.
There are tens of millions of Americans who are paying too much for their mortgages.
That's Chris Mayer, an economist at Columbia University, who for years now has been pushing for what's termed a mass refi program.
A widespread refinancing program would have many benefits, not only helping the economy and putting tens of billions of dollars of money back in consumers' pockets, the equivalent of a very long-term tax cut, but it also is likely to reduce foreclosures.
Scott Simon heads up mortgage securities trading for the giant bond investment fund PIMCO. He says he was shocked by Freddie Mac's investments. Simon says the investments are risky and they give the company an incentive against large-scale refinancings.
If there was a mass refi program, the bets they made would get absolutely wiped out. The way these bets do the best is if the homeowner is barred from refinancing.
Freddie Mac is now controlled by its regulator, the Federal Housing Finance Agency. The FHFA late today said in a statement that Freddie is not doing any more of these controversial trades, but it acknowledged that Freddie Mac still holds $5 billion worth of these bets. Freddie Mac says it refinanced loans for hundreds of thousands of borrowers last year and says that there's a firewall between its investments and its lending policies. But economist Chris Mayer says
it's really outrageous. The idea that 3 years into the crisis, under government conservatorship, that the government would allow this kind of behavior to occur.
Freddie Mac and other parts of the mortgage industry have been tightening credit on homeowners in recent years. And no one disagrees that some of that is definitely justified. Lending standards were clearly too loose leading up to the housing bubble. Chris Mayer thinks that the pendulum has now swung too far, but not all economists think that Fannie and Freddie should be allowing millions more Americans to refinance.
It's a cost to the taxpayer.
Anthony Sanders is an economist at George Mason University. He disagrees with Chris Mayer. He thinks a mass refi program would cost taxpayers much more money than Mayer says, even setting aside these bets by Freddie Mac.
This means Fannie and Freddie are going to suffer even greater losses. And so that's one of those public policy decisions that is very, very difficult.
But when it comes to Freddie's trades, even Sanders sees a conflict there. He says his email inbox has been getting hit all day with economists and policy experts reacting.
Everyone is in various degrees of rage. They've been writing back saying, terrible debacle by Freddie Mac.
Sanders says this is further evidence that Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae should be forced to quickly sell off the large investment portfolios that they hold worth hundreds of billions of dollars.
They don't need these staggering Chernobyls sitting over there on the both sides of the Potomac.
Sanders says there are just too many potential conflicts there for regulators to keep track of. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
The FBI raised eyebrows in the tech world recently. It put out a call for advice on how to harvest information from Facebook, Twitter, and other social networking sites. The Bureau wants to troll these sites for signs of a national security threat.
That means scanning public posts, past and present, to learn about breaking news or to find patterns by so-called bad actors. Here to talk more about this kind of intelligence work is Sean Gourley. He's worked with defense agencies in the past and now heads a high-tech intelligence firm called Quid. Hello there, Sean.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. So to start, on a technological level, what exactly does the FBI and the Justice Department want to do here, and how would such a program work?
Look, what they're really trying to do is to try and gather what's called open source intelligence. Now, open source intelligence has been around since the time of the Second World War, when you would look at the price of oranges in Germany and try and understand if a fluctuation in the price of oranges would mean that a bridge had been bombed. And now it's kind of taking that into kind of the world that we live in today and saying, well, you know, does a stream of tweets mentioning, you know, the word bomb or explosion mean that there's been an activity that's happened that we should be aware of? Now, what they're trying to do is take this information and turn it into intelligence that they can use to guide the emergence of threats or bombings or terrorist activities, or indeed any other kind of things that the FBI would want to do with it.
Now, let's give some examples here. What kind of security profile could they create on a person or a group based on the information that the average social network user already makes available?
So I think, you know, the first thing that they'd probably want to do with this kind of stuff is to see and get intelligence oversight into what's going on. So if there's an attack that's sort of just being carried out in northern Afghanistan that they weren't aware of, there might be reports of that on the social media channels that they're watching, and they start to recombine this mosaic back together to say, yeah, we can be pretty sure that something happened here, and here's what we think it is.
Now, in their call for information, they definitely mentioned that they'd want to be able to search terms like lockdown or bomb or white powder. And that seems pretty easy. You could do that on Twitter right now. But there were other things that seemed a little bit more complicated, like one quote here, to predict future events taken by bad actors. Now, what does that mean?
So the idea there is what we sort of get into a statistical modeling, and we can look at the statistical profiles of their social media postings or their geolocations from Foursquare check-ins or something along those lines. And what they can do with that is then say, here's the kind of profile of somebody that we'd potentially be interested in, even if we don't know that they're already a bad actor. And so you start to get into the kind of predictive modeling space. Now, I should, you know, kind of say that this stuff is all very experimental at the moment, and by no means does it exist today.
The FBI says that this has said specifically in a statement that this would not focus on specific people or protected groups. But, you know, I have to wonder, in an era where where the privacy policies for Google or Facebook seem like they're changing all the time, how you really protect yourself as a citizen.
Look, the world that we live in now is really one we've sort of become accustomed to sharing little snippets of our lives. Now, we're sort of okay with this as long as it's just serving us ads and we can buy a pair of trainers. But I think we'll start to find in the coming years that the information trails that we leave behind will also start to define us.
So where you spend your money, how you spend your time could sort of paint a picture of what you like to do, what kind of person you would be, how likely you are to attack someone else? I'm not sure what you're saying.
I mean, so at the moment, that information is being collected and it's being used to serve the ads that you see on Facebook. You know, Facebook will serve you up an ad based on the history of things that you've done. What it really hasn't been applied to in any great sort of systematic way is looking to see if you're a terrorist. Now, it's still a moot point as to whether that can be done, because indeed, serving up a book recommendation is a lot more simple than serving up a kind of a warrant for an arrest.
Right, and even some of those companies don't do that very well when you
right.
think about
Now, we've
it.
All seen the kind of people like you may like this book, and we've seen that go wrong. And that's okay when it goes wrong with a book recommendation. It may not be okay if it goes wrong and you end up in jail.
Sean Gourley, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Sean Gourley, he's head of the high-tech intelligence firm, Quid.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, automatically backing up computer files for individuals and small businesses worldwide. Learn more at carbonite.com.
This is NPR News.
Finally, here's another one of my stories about how the personal gets political. You know how it sometimes happens that without planning it, you and your friends wind up doing the same thing around the same time? Well, it so happened that a number of my friends got married around roughly the same time I did. So as you might imagine, we started comparing notes. One day, I decided to check out the wares in the salon of a famous designer I had heard a lot about. Did I say salon? I should have said showroom, although I've had a better time actually buying the proverbial used car. The sales lady was pushy and rude. She made no pretense of being interested in what I wanted. No, she was all about what she wanted, which was to get me out of there as soon as possible so she could get her hooks into somebody gullible enough to pay not one but two mortgage payments for a dress to wear one time. After the third time, she asked me, "So are you going to buy it?" I got the message. I got out of there and bought a very nice gown from a store where I bought the rest of my clothes. Thank you very much. So I reported all this to a friend of mine who was getting married soon after I was, just as an FYI. Only, guess what? She didn't believe me until the exact same thing happened to her in the exact same store. I'll translate this for you. She evidently thought I was having a black girl retail moment, and it didn't have anything to do with her blonde self. Until it did. Can I just tell you, it's a small story that illustrates a larger truth, that what happens to a few folks very often becomes the prelude to what happens to the many, except that the many often don't want to think so until it's too late. African-American elders used to have jokes about this. They'd call themselves the canaries in the coal mine, among other things, except that it has proven true too often to be funny. The areas of marriage and relationships are but one example. The low marriage rates of African Americans have become something of a national preoccupation among everybody from scholars to pundits to comics, except that while various analysts have been busy mulling over what's wrong with those people, black men or black women or both, the marriage rate among all Americans has been steadily dropping. In 1960, more than half of all Americans aged 18 to 29 were married. Today, that number is 22%. 40% of all children are now born to single mothers. And what's more, these numbers reflect real shifts in attitudes about marriage. According to the Pew Research Center, 44% of millennials and 43% of Gen Xers think marriage is obsolete. This isn't the only example. For years, African Americans have been quietly and then loudly concerned about the fact that more African American girls than boys were attending and completing college. They worried about the social and economic impact of having a mismatch in educational attainment, since increasingly people of similar education prefer to partner with each other. Well, lo and behold, the same phenomenon is now being seen across the population. In 2010, 55% of all college graduates aged 25 to 29 were female. I could go on, but you get the point. It is often the case, and not just with black folks, but with other minorities, that the complaints and concerns of one group are dismissed as their problem, when it is actually everybody's problem, if not in the short term, then eventually. So that is why it seems to me, as this show heads out to Detroit, and as we all gear up to choose, as we do every 4 years, who should lead the country, it seems pertinent to consider the specific concerns being raised about the substance and tone of the national debate. That's not to favor one particular path forward over another, as there are often many routes to the same destination, but only to say that as we go down into the mines, the canary's life you save might be your own. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow from Detroit.